J is for Judgment by Sue Grafton. Copyright 1993 by Sue Grafton.
This recording of the full-length reading of J is for Judgment was published by arrangement with Sue Grafton, care of the Aaron M. Priest Literary Agency, Incorporated, and was produced in 1994 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Mary Pfeiffer. Chapter 1. On the face of it, you wouldn't think there was any connection between the murder of a dead man and the events that changed my perceptions about my life. In truth, the facts about Wendell Jaffe had nothing to do with my family history. But murder is seldom tidy, and no one ever said revelations operate in a straight line. It was my investigation into the dead man's past that triggered the inquiry into my own, and in the end, the two stories became difficult to separate. The hard thing about death is that nothing ever changes. The hard thing about life is that nothing stays the same. It began with a phone call. Not to me, but to Mac Voorhees, one of the vice presidents at California Fidelity Insurance, for whom I once worked. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a licensed California private investigator working out of Santa Teresa, which is 95 miles north of Los Angeles. My association with CF Insurance had been terminated the previous December, and I hadn't had much occasion to return to 903 State. For the past 7 months, I'd been leasing office space from the law firm of Kingman and Dives. Lonnie Kingman's practice is largely criminal, but he also enjoys the complexities of trials involving accidental injury or wrongful death. He's been my attorney of record for a number of years, stepping in with legal counsel when the occasion arises. Lonnie is short and beefy, a bodybuilder and a scrapper. John Ives is the quiet one, who prefers the intellectual challenges of appellate work. I'm the only person I know who doesn't express routine contempt for all the lawyers in the world. Just for the record, I like cops, too. Anyone who stands between me and anarchy. Kingman and Ives occupies the entire upper floor of a small building downtown. Lonnie's firm consists of himself, his law partner John Ives, and an attorney named Martin Cheltenham, Lonnie's best friend, who leases offices from him. The bulk of the day-to-day work is attended by the two legal secretaries, Ida Ruth and Jill. We also have a receptionist named Allison and a paralegal named Jim Thicket. The space I moved into used to be a conference room with a makeshift kitchenette. After Lonnie annexed the last available office on the third floor, he had a new kitchen built, along with a room for the copying equipment. My office is large enough to accommodate a desk, my swivel chair, some file cabinets, a mini refrigerator and coffee maker, plus a big storage closet stacked with packing boxes untouched since the move. I have my own separate phone line in addition to the two lines I share with the firm. I still have my answering machine, but in a pinch, Ida Ruth covers incoming calls for me. For a while, I made a pass at finding another office to rent. I had sufficient money to make the move. A sidebar to a case I was working before Christmas resulted in my picking up a $25,000 check. I put the money in some CDs, the bank kind, not the music, where it was happily collecting interest. In the meantime, I discovered how much I liked my current circumstances. The location was good, and it was nice to have people around me at work. One of the few disadvantages of living alone is not having anyone to tell when you're going someplace. At least now at work I had people who were aware of my whereabouts, and I could check in with them if I needed any mothering. For the past hour and a half on that Monday morning in mid-July, I'd sat and made phone calls on a skip trace I was working. A Nashville private investigator had written me a letter asking if I'd check local sources for his client's ex-husband, who was $6,000 in arrears on his child support. Rumor had it that the fellow had left Tennessee and headed for California with the intention of settling somewhere in Perdido or Santa Teresa counties. I'd been given the subject's name, his previous address, his birth date, and his social security number, with instructions to develop any lead I could. I also had the make and model of the vehicle he was last seen driving, as well as his Tennessee license plate number. I'd already written two letters to Sacramento, one to request driver's license information on the subject, another to see if he'd registered in his 1983 Ford pickup. Now I was calling the various public utility companies in the area, trying to see if there were any recent hookups in the guy's name. So far, I hadn't hit pay dirt, but it was fun anyway. For $50 an hour, I'll do just about anything. When Allison buzzed me on the intercom, I leaned over automatically and depressed the lever.
Yes?
You have a visitor, she said. She's 24 years old, bubbly and energetic. She has blonde hair to her waist, buys all her clothes in a size 4 petite, and dots the I in her name with a heart or a daisy, depending on her mood, which is always good. Somehow she sounded as if she were calling on one of those telephones kids make with two Dixie cups and a length of string.
A Mr. Voorhees with California Fidelity Insurance?
Like a comic strip character, I could feel a question mark form above my head. I squinted, leaning closer. Mac Voorhees is out there?
You want me to send him back?
I'll come out, I said. I couldn't believe it. Mac was the man who supervised most of the cases I'd worked for CF. It was his boss, Gordon Titus, who'd fired my sorry ass, and while I'd made my peace with the change in my employment, I could still feel a flush of adrenaline at the thought of the man. Briefly, I entertained a little fantasy that Gordon Titus had sent Mac to offer his abject apologies. Fat chance, I thought. I did a hasty survey of the office, hoping it didn't look like I'd fallen on hard times. The room wasn't large, but I had my own window, lots of clean white wall space and burnt orange carpeting and an expensive wool shag. With three framed watercolors and a leafy 4-foot ficus plant, I thought the place looked very tasteful. Well, okay, the ficus was a fake, some sort of laminated fabric tinted with accumulated dust. But you really couldn't tell unless you got up real close. I would have checked my reflection. Mac's arrival was already having that effect. But I don't carry a compact, and I already knew what I'd see. Dark hair, hazel eyes, not a smidge of makeup. As usual, I was wearing jeans, my boots, and a turtleneck. I licked my palm and ran a hand across my shaggy head, hoping to smooth down any stick-up parts. The week before, in a fit of exasperation, I'd picked up a pair of nail scissors and whacked all my hair off. The results were just about what you'd expect. I hung a left in the corridor, passing several offices on my way to the front. Mac was standing by Allison's desk out in the reception area. Mac's in his early 60s, tall and scowling, with a flyaway halo of wispy gray hair. His brooding black eyes are set slightly askew in a long, bony face. In lieu of his usual cigar, he was smoking a cigarette, ash tumbling down the front of his three-piece suit. Mac has never been one to plague himself with attempts at fitness, and his body at this point resembles a drawing from a child's perspective. Long arms and legs, foreshortened trunk, with a little head stuck on top. I said, "Mac?" He said, "Hello, Kinsey," in a wonderful, wry tone. I was so happy to see him that I started laughing out loud. Like some great galumphing pup, I loped over to the man and flung myself into his arms. This behavior was greeted by one of Mac's rare smiles, revealing teeth that were tarnished from all the cigarettes he smoked.
"It's been a long time," he said.
"I can't believe you're here. Come on back to my office and we can visit," I said. "You want some coffee?"
"No, thanks. I just had some."
Mac turned to stub out his cigarette, realizing belatedly that there weren't any ashtrays in the area. He looked around with puzzlement, his gaze resting briefly on the potted plant on Allison's desk. She leaned forward.
"Here, why don't you let me take that?"
She removed the cigarette from his fingers and took the burning butt directly to the open window, where she gave it a toss, peering out afterward to make sure it didn't land in someone's open convertible in the parking lot. Mac followed me down the hall, making polite responses, as I filled him in on my current circumstances. When we reached my office, he was properly complimentary. We caught up on gossip, exchanging news about mutual friends. The pleasantries gave me time to study the man at close range. The years seemed to be speeding right along for him. He'd lost color. He'd lost about 10 pounds by the look of him. He seemed tired and uncertain, which was completely uncharacteristic. The Mac Voorhees of old had been brusque and impatient,
fair-minded, decisive, humorless, and conservative. He was a decent man to work for, and I admired his testiness, which was born of a passion for getting the job done right. Now the spark was missing, and I was alerted by the loss.
"Are you okay? You don't seem like your old self somehow."
He gestured peevishly in an unexpected flash of energy.
"They're taking all the fun out of the job, I swear to God. Damn executives with all their talk about the bottom line. I know the insurance business. Hell, I've been at it long enough. CF used to be family. We had a company to run, but we did it with compassion, and we respected each other's turf. We didn't stab each other in the back, and we didn't shortchange any claimants. Now, I don't know, Kinsey. The turnover's ridiculous. Agents are run through so fast they hardly have a chance to unpack their briefcases. All this talk about profit margins and cost containment. Lately I find myself not wanting to go to work."
He paused, looking sheepish, color coming up in his face.
"God, would you listen? I'm beginning to sound like a garrulous old fart, which is what I am. They offered me an early retirement package, whatever the hell that means. You know, they're maneuvering to get some of us old birds off the payroll as soon as possible. We earn way too much, and we're too set in our ways."
"You going to do it?"
"I haven't decided yet, but I might. I just might. I'm 61, and I'm tired. I'd like to spend time with my grandkids before I drop in my tracks. Marie and I could sell the house and get an RV, see some of the country and visit the clan, keep making the rounds so we don't wear out our welcome."
Mac and his wife had 8 grown kids, all of them married with countless children of their own. He waved the subject aside, his mind apparently focused on something else.
"Enough of that stuff. I got another month to decide. Meantime, something's come up and I thought about you."
I waited, letting him get around to the subject in his own good time. Mac always did better when he set the stage for himself. He took out a pack of Marlboros and shook a cigarette into view. He dried his lips with one knuckle before he put the cigarette between his teeth. He took out a pack of matches and lit up, extinguishing the match flame with a mouthful of smoke. He crossed his legs and used his pants cuff as an ashtray, leaving me to worry he'd set his nylon socks ablaze.
"Remember Wendell Jaffe's disappearance about 5 years back?"
"Vaguely," I said. As nearly as I remembered, Jaffe's sailboat had been found abandoned and adrift off the coast of Baja. "Run it by me again. He's the guy who vanished out at sea, right?"
"So it appeared."
Max seemed to wag his head, casting about for a quick narrative summary.
"Wendell Jaffe and his partner, Carl Eckert, put together limited partnerships for real estate deals, to develop raw land, build condominiums, office buildings, shopping centers, that kind of thing. They were promising investors a 15% return, plus the return of their original investment within 4 years before the two partners would take a profit. Of course, they got in way over their heads, taking off big fees, paying huge overhead expenses, rewarding themselves handsomely. When profits failed to materialize, they ended up paying old investors with the new investors' money, shifting cash from one shell company to the next, constantly soliciting new business to keep the game afloat."
"In other words, a Ponzi scheme," I inserted.
"Right. I think they started with good intentions, but that's how it ended up. Anyway, Wendell began to see that it couldn't go on forever, and that's when he went off the side of that boat. His body never surfaced."
"He left a suicide note, as I recall," I said.
"That he did. From all reports, the man was exhibiting all the classic symptoms of depression. Low spirits, poor appetite, anxiety, insomnia. He finally goes off on his fishing boat and jumps overboard, leaving a letter to his wife. In it, he says he's borrowed every cent he can, pouring it into what he now realizes is a hopelessly failing business. He owes everybody. He knows he's let everybody down, and he just can't face the consequences. Meantime, she and his 2 sons were in a hell of a situation."
"What ages were his kids?"
"I believe the older boy, Michael, was 17, and Brian was about 12. Jesus, what a mess. The scandal left his family reeling and forced some of his investors into bankruptcy. His business partner, Carl Eckert, ended up in jail. It looked like Jaffe jumped just before his house of cards collapsed. The problem was, there really wasn't any concrete proof of death.
His wife petitioned for a court-appointed administrator to manage his assets, or the few he had left. The bank accounts had been stripped and the house was mortgaged to the hilt. She ended up losing that. I felt sorry for the woman. She hadn't worked in years, since the day she married him. Suddenly she had these two kids to support, not a cent in the bank, and no marketable skills. Nice lady, too, and it was rough on her. Since then, we've had 5 years of dead silence. Not a whisper of the man, not a trace.
But he wasn't dead? I said, anticipating the punchline.
Well, now I'm getting to that, Max said with a touch of irritation. I tried to silence my question so he could tell it his way. The question did come up. Insurance company wasn't anxious to pay off without a death certificate, especially after Wendell's partner was charged with fraud and grand theft. For all we knew, he was a skip, taking off with the bucks to avoid prosecution. We never said as much, but we were dragging our feet. Dana Jaffe hired a private investigator who initiated a search, but never turned up a shred of evidence, pro or con. Mac went on. Couldn't prove he was dead, but you couldn't prove he wasn't either. A year after the incident, she petitioned the court to have the man declared dead, citing the suicide note and his depressed mental state. Presented affidavits and whatnot, testimony from his partner and various friends. At that point, she notified CF she was filing a claim as his sole beneficiary. We launched our own investigation, which was fairly intense. Bill Bargeman handled it. You remember him? Name sounds familiar, but I don't think we ever met. He was probably working out of the Pasadena office back then. Good man. He's retired now. Anyway, he did what he could, but there was no way we could prove Wendell Jaffe was alive. We did manage to overcome the presumption of death, temporarily. In light of his financial problems, we argued successfully that it was unlikely, if Jaffe was living, that he'd voluntarily appear. Judge ruled in our favor, but we knew it was only a matter of time before he reversed himself. Mrs. Jaffe was plenty mad, but all she had to do was wait. She kept the premiums on his policy paid and went back into court when the 5 years were up. I thought it was 7. The statute was changed about a year ago. The Law Revision Commission modernized the procedure for probate in the estate of a missing person. 2 months ago, she finally got a finding and order from the Superior Court and had Wendell declared dead. At that point, the company really had no choice. We paid.
Ah, the thick plottins, I said. How much are we talking?
$500,000.
Not bad, I said, though maybe she deserved it. She sure had to wait long enough to collect.
Mac's smile was brief. She should have waited a little longer. I had a call from Dick Mills, another retired CF employee. He claims he spotted Jaffe down in Mexico, town called Viento Negro.
Really? When was this?
Yesterday, Mac said. Dick was the agent who sold Jaffe the original life insurance policy, and he went on to do a lot of business with him afterward. Anyway, he was down in Mexico, dinky little place midway between Cabo and La Paz on the Gulf of California. He says he saw Wendell in the hotel bar having drinks with some woman.
Just like that?
Just like that, he echoed. Dick was waiting for the shuttle on his way out to the airport, and he stopped off in the bar to have a quick one before the driver showed. Wendell was sitting on the patio maybe 3 feet away, a little trellis arrangement between the two of them. Dick said it was the voice he recognized first, kind of gravelly and low with a South Texas accent. Guy was speaking English at first, but he switched to Spanish when the waiter came over.
Did Wendell see Dick?
Apparently not. Dick said he was never so surprised in his life. Said he sat there so long he nearly missed his ride to the airport. The minute he got home, he picked up the phone and called me.
I could feel my heart begin to thump. Put me anywhere close to an interesting proposition and my pulse accelerates.
So what happens next?
Mac tapped a length of ash into his pants cuff.
I want you to go down there as soon as possible. I'm assuming you have a valid passport in your possession.
Well, sure, but what about Gordon Titus? Does he know about this?
You let me worry about Titus. This thing with Wendell has been sticking in my craw ever since it happened. I want to see it settled before I leave CF. $500,000 is nothing to sniff at. Seems like it'd be a nice way to close out my career. If it's true, I said. I've never known Dick Mills to make a mistake. Will you do it?
I'd have to make sure I can clear my schedule here. Can I call you in an hour and give you an answer then?
Well, sure. That's no problem.
Mac checked his watch and stood up, placing a thick packet on the corner of my desk.
I wouldn't take much more time if I were you. You're on a flight leaves at 1 for Los Angeles. Connecting flights at 5. Tickets and itinerary are in there, he said.
I started laughing. California Fidelity and I were back in business.
Chapter 2. Once my commuter flight landed at LAX, I had a 3-hour delay before the Mexicana flight took off for Cabo San Lucas. Mac had given me a folder full of newspaper articles about Jaffe's disappearance and its aftermath. I settled myself in one of the airport cocktail lounges, sorting through the clippings to educate myself while I sipped a margarita. Might as well get into the spirit of the thing. At my feet, I had a hastily packed duffel bag, including my 35mm camera, my binoculars, and the video recorder I'd given myself as a 34th birthday present. I loved the impromptu nature of this trip, and I was already feeling that heightened sense of self-awareness that traveling engenders. My friend Vera and I were currently enrolled in a beginning Spanish class through Santa Teresa's adult education program. So far, we were confined to the present tense. Short, mostly declarative statements of little-known use. Unless, of course, there were some black cats in the trees, in which case Vera and I were prepared to point and make remarks.
Muchos gatos negros están en los árboles, ¿sí? Sí, muchos gatos.
I saw the trip as an opportunity to test my language skills, if nothing else. Along with the clippings, Mac had included several 8x11 black-and-white shots of Jaffe at various public functions, art openings, political fundraisers, charity auctions. Judging by the events he attended, he was certainly one of the select. Handsome, well-dressed, a central part of any group. Often his was the one blurred face, as if he'd pulled back or turned away just as the camera shutter clicked. I wondered if even then he was consciously avoiding being photographed. He was in his mid-50s and big. Silver hair, high cheekbones, jutting chin, his nose prominent. He seemed calm and self-possessed, a man who didn't care much what other people thought. In a curious way, I felt a fleeting bond with the man as I tried on the idea of changing identities. Being a liar by nature, I've always been attracted to the possibility. There's a certain romance in the notion of walking out of one life and into another, like an actor passing from one character role to the next. Not that long ago, I'd handled a case in which a fellow convicted of murder had walked away from a prison work crew and had managed to create a whole new persona for himself. In the process, he'd shed not only his past, but the taint of the homicide conviction. He'd acquired a new family and a good job. He was respected in his new community. He might have continued pulling off the deception except for an error in a bench warrant that resulted in a fluke arrest some 17 years later. The past has a way of catching up with all of us. I checked my watch and saw that it was time to go. I packed away the clippings and grabbed my duffel bag. I moved through the main terminal, cleared security, and began the long trek down the concourse to my posted gate. One immutable law of travel is that one's arrival or departure gate is always at the extreme outer limit of the terminal, especially if your bag is heavy or your shoes have just begun to pinch. I sat in the boarding area and rubbed one foot while my fellow passengers assembled, waiting for the gate agent to call our flight. Once I was seated on the plane, with my duffel stowed in the bin above, I pulled out the glossy hotel brochure Mac had enclosed with the tickets. In addition to my flights, he'd booked accommodations for me at the same resort where Wendell Jaffe had been seen. I wasn't convinced the guy would still be in residence, but who was I to turn down a free vacation? The picture of the Hacienda Grande de Viento Negro showed a 3-storied structure with a stretch of dark beach faintly visible in the foreground. The blurb under the photograph boasted of a restaurant, 2 bars, and a heated swimming pool, with recreational activities that included tennis, snorkeling, deep-sea fishing, a bus tour of the town, and complimentary margaritas. The woman in the next seat was reading over my shoulder. I nearly shielded my paper as if she were cheating on a test. She was in her 40s, very thin, very tanned, and sleek. She wore her black hair in a French braid and was dressed in a black pantsuit with a tan shell underneath. There was not a hint of color on her any place.
Are you headed for VN?
Yes. Do you know the area?
Yes, I do, and I hope you're not planning to stay there, she said.
She was pointing at the brochure with a little moo of distaste. What's the matter with the place? It looks fine to me. She pushed her tongue along the inside of her cheek as though she were checking her gums. Her brow lifted slightly.
It's your money, I guess.
Actually, it's someone else's money. This is business, I said. She nodded, clearly unconvinced. She occupied herself with her magazine, a look on her face like she was trying not to butt in. After a moment, I saw her murmur a comment to the man on her right. Her traveling companion in the window seat had a wad of Kleenex hanging out of one nostril, stanching a nosebleed that had apparently been induced by increasing cabin pressure as the plane prepared for takeoff. The twist of tissue looked like a fat hand-rolled cigarette. He leaned forward slightly to get a better look at me. I turned my attention to the woman again. Really? Is there a problem?
I'm sure it's fine, she said faintly.
Depending on how you feel about dust, humidity, and bugs, the man interjected. I laughed. Heh, heh, heh. On the assumption that he was kidding. Neither one of them cracked a smile. Belatedly, I learned that viento negro means black wind, a fair description of the blizzard of dark lava soot that swirled up from the beach late every afternoon. The hotel was modest, an upside-down U-shape painted apricot yellow with little balconies across the front. Alternate patios had planters affixed to the railings, with bougainvillea tumbling down in a waterfall of magenta. The room was clean, but faintly shabby, looking out across the Gulf of California to the east. For 2 days I cruised both the Hacienda Grande and the town of Viento Negro, looking for anyone who even halfway resembled the 5-year-old photographs of Wendell Jaffe. If all else failed, I could try to quiz the staff in my amateur Spanish, but I worried that one of them might tip him off to the inquiry. If he was there, that is. I hung out by the pool, loitered in the hotel lobby, took the shuttle into town. I tried all the tourist attractions, the sunset cruise, a snorkeling expedition, a bumpy, ass-agonizing jaunt on a rented all-terrain vehicle, roaring up and down dusty mountain trails. I tried the two other hotels in the area, local restaurants and bars. I sampled the nightly entertainment at the hotel where I was staying, all the discos, all the shops. There was no sign of him. I finally managed to get a call through to Mac at home and filled him in on my efforts to date. This is costing a lot of money if he's already blown out of here, assuming your friend actually saw Wendell Jaffe in the first place.
Dick swore it was him.
After 5 long years?
Look, just keep at it for another couple of days. If he doesn't turn up by the end of the week, you can head on home.
Happy to oblige. I just like to warn you when I don't get results.
I understand that. Keep trying.
You're the boss, I said. I learned to like the town, which was a 10-minute taxi ride from the hotel down a dusty 2-lane road. Most construction I passed was in a state of incompletion, raw cinder block and rebar abandoned to the weeds. A once stunning view of the harbor was obscured now by condominiums, and the streets were filled with tots selling chiclets for 100 pesos apiece. Dogs napped in the sunshine, sprawling on the sidewalks wherever it suited them, apparently trusting the local citizens to leave them unmolested. The storefronts that lined the main street were painted harsh blues and yellows, bright reds and parrot greens, as gaudy as jungle flowers. Billboards proclaimed far-flung commercial influences from Fuji color film to Century 21 real estate. Most cars were parked with 2 wheels on the sidewalk, and the license plate suggested an influx of tourists from as far away as Oklahoma. The merchants were polite and responded with patience to my halting Spanish. There was no evidence of crime or civil rowdiness.
Everyone was too dependent on the visiting Americans to risk offense. Even so, the goods in the market stalls were shoddy and overpriced, and the fare in the restaurants was strictly second-rate. Restlessly, I wandered from one location to the next, scanning the crowds for Wendell Jaffe or his look-alike. On Wednesday afternoon, day 2.5 of my stay, I finally gave up the search and retired to the pool, where I lathered myself with a glistening coat of sunscreen that made me smell like a freshly baked coconut macaroon. I had donned a faded black bikini, boldly exposing a body riddled with old bullet holes and crisscrossed with pale scars from the assorted injuries that had been inflicted on me over the years. Many people seemed to worry about the state of my health. At the moment, I was faintly orange, having recently applied a primer coat of tan in a can to disguise my winter pallor. Of course, I'd missed in places, and my ankles were oddly splotched with what looked like tawny hepatitis. I tipped my wide-brimmed straw hat down across my face, trying not to think about the sweat collecting on the underside of my burnt umber knees. Sunbathing has to be the most boring pastime on the planet. On the plus side, I was disconnected from telephones and TV. I hadn't any notion what was happening in the world. I must have dozed because the next thing I became aware of was the rattle of newspaper and a conversation in Spanish taking place between two people on the chaises to my right. Here's how a conversation in Spanish sounds to someone with my limited vocabulary. Blah, 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 but. Blah, 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 because. Blah, 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 here. A woman whose accent was clearly American was saying something about Perdido, California, the small town 30 miles south of Santa Teresa. I perked right up. I was in the process of lifting the brim of my hat so I could see who she was when her male companion responded in a rift of Spanish. I adjusted my hat, turning by degrees until he came into view. Shit, it had to be Jaffe. If I made allowances for aging and cosmetic surgery, this guy was certainly a distinct possibility. I can't say he was a dead ringer for the Wendell Jaffe in the pictures, but he was close enough. The age, the build, something about the man's posture and the way he held his head, characteristics he probably wasn't aware were part of the image he projected. He was scanning the newspaper, his eye moving restlessly from one column to the next. He sensed my scrutiny and flashed a cautious look in my direction. His gaze held mine briefly while the woman rattled on. Emotions shifted in his face, and he touched her arm with a warning look at me. The flow of talk was halted temporarily. I liked the paranoia. It spoke volumes about his mental state. Smoothly, I reached down and retrieved my straw tote, fussing in its depths until his attention was focused elsewhere. And me without my camera. I was kicking myself. I pulled out my paperback, which I opened to the middle. I flicked an imaginary bug from my calf and then inspected the site, conveying, I hoped, a complete lack of interest. They took up their conversation in lowered tones. Meanwhile, I was running a set of mental flashcards, comparing the guy's face to one in my folder. It was the eyes that betrayed him, dark and deep-set under platinum brows. I studied the woman with him, feeling reasonably certain I'd never seen her before. She was in her 40s, very small and dark, tanned to the color of polished pecan wood. She had breasts like paperweights in a halter made of hemp, and the arc of her bikini bottom indicated she'd been waxed where it hurt. I settled down on my chaise with my hat across my face, eavesdropping shamelessly on the escalating conflict. The two chattered on in Spanish, and the nature of the dialogue seemed to shift from simple upset to intense debate. She broke it off abruptly, withdrawing into one of those injured silences men never seem to know how to penetrate. They lay on adjacent chaises for much of the afternoon, hardly speaking, interaction at a minimum. I would have loved to snap some pictures. Twice I considered a quick run up to the room, but I thought it would look weird if I came back moments later loaded down with photographic equipment. It seemed better to wait and bide my time. The two were clearly guests of the hotel, and I couldn't imagine them checking out this late in the day. Tomorrow I would take some pictures. Today I'd let them get used to the sight of me. At 5 o'clock the wind began to rattle through the palms, and a haze of black dust spiraled up from the beach.
I could feel the sand blow against my skin like talcum powder. I tasted grit, and my eyes were soon watering in response. The few hotel guests within range of me started packing up in haste. I knew from experience that the gusts of soot would abate automatically once the sun began to set. In the meantime, even the towel boy working the concession stand closed his booth and fled for cover. The man I'd been watching pulled himself to his feet. His companion waved a hand in front of her face as if to fan away a cloud of gnats. She gathered up their belongings, ducking her head to avoid getting dust in her eyes. She said something to him in Spanish and then moved off toward the hotel at a rapid pace. He took his sweet time, apparently undismayed by the sudden shift in weather. He folded the towels. He screwed the lid on a tube of sunscreen, tucked odds and ends in a beach bag, and ambled toward the hotel as she had only moments before. He seemed in no hurry to catch up with her. Maybe he was a man who liked to bypass confrontation. I gave him some leeway and then stuffed my belongings in my beach tote and followed. I entered the lower lobby, which was usually left open to the elements. Bright canvas sofas faced a television set. Chairs were arranged in small conversational groupings for the smattering of guests. The ceiling rose 2 floors to a railing above that marked the upper lobby, with its registration desk. There was no sign of the couple. The bartender was bolting tall wooden shutters into place, barricading the room against the hot, stinging wind. The bar was immediately bathed in an artificial gloom. I went up the wide, polished stairs to the left, checking the main lobby, which was located on the floor above. I headed for the hotel entrance on the off chance that the two were staying somewhere else, perhaps retrieving their vehicle from the hotel parking lot. The grounds were deserted, people driven indoors by the mounting fury of the winds. I moved back to the elevators and went up to my room. By the time I secured the sliding doors to the balcony, the sand was being blown against the glass like a sudden summer rainstorm. Outside, the day was shrouded in a synthetic twilight. Wendell and the woman were somewhere in the hotel, probably holing up in their room just as I was in mine. I pulled out my book, tucked myself under the faded cotton coverlet, and read until my eyes closed in sleep. At 6 o'clock, I woke with a start. The wind was down, and the overworked air conditioning had made the room too cold for comfort. The sunlight was fading to the mellow gold of late day, brushing my walls with a pale wash of maize. Outside, I could hear the maintenance crew begin its daily sweeping. All the walks and patios would be cleared, and the piles of black sand would be returned to the beach. I showered and dressed. I made a beeline for the lobby and began my circle of the premises, hoping to catch sight of the couple again. I scanned the hotel restaurant, the 2 bars, the patio, the courtyard. Maybe they were napping or having dinner in their room. Maybe they'd taxied into town for a bite to eat. I snagged a taxi myself and headed into Viento Negro. The town at that hour was just coming to life. The sinking sun briefly gilded all the telephone wires. The air was thick with heat and laced with the dry scent of the chaparral. The only contribution from the Gulf was the faint sulphurous smell of wharf pilings and gutted marlin. I found an empty table for 2 in an open-air cafe overlooking a half-completed construction site. All the weedy cinder block and rusted fencing didn't dull my appetite in the least. I sat on a rickety metal folding chair with a paper plate of boiled shrimp, which I peeled and dipped in salsa, forking the accompanying black beans and rice into a soft corn tortilla. Canned music played, jittery and tuneless, brass harmonies blasting out of the speakers overhead. The beer was ice-cold, and the food, while mediocre, was at least cheap and filling. I went back to the hotel at 8:35. Again I scanned the lobby and then toured the hotel restaurant and both bars. There was no sign of Wendell or the woman I'd seen him with. I couldn't believe he'd be traveling under the name Jaffe, so there wasn't much point in asking for him at the desk. I hoped they hadn't decamped. I roamed the place for an hour and finally settled on the sofa in the lobby near the entrance. I rummaged in my handbag for my paperback novel and read inattentively until well after midnight. Finally, I gave it up and returned to my room. Surely the 2 would resurface by morning. Maybe I could find out the name he was currently using. I wasn't sure what I'd do with the information, but I was certain Mac would take an interest.
Chapter 3
The next morning I got up at 6 o'clock for a run on the beach. The morning after I arrived, I'd timed out a mile and a half in each direction. Now I reduced that to quarter-mile loops so I could keep the hotel in view. I kept hoping I would spot them, on the terrace above the pool, taking an early morning walk on the sand. Unlikely as it seemed, I was still worried they might have checked out in the night. After my run, I went up to my room, took a quick shower, and dressed. I loaded film in my camera and hung it around my neck by its strap, returning to the sunroom off the upper lobby, where breakfast was being served. I chose a seat near the open door, placing my camera on the seat of the chair next to mine. I kept a restless eye on the elevator doors while I ordered coffee, juice, and cereal. I stretched out the meal as far as I could, but neither Wendell nor the woman made an appearance. I signed the check, grabbed my camera, and went downstairs to the pool. Other guests had appeared. A pride of prepubescent males pushed and shoved each other in the water, while a pair of newlyweds played ping-pong in the courtyard. I circled the hotel and headed back inside, passing through the bar in the lower lobby as I went up the stairs. My anxiety was rising. Then I spotted her. She was standing near the elevator doors with a couple of different editions of the newspapers in hand. Apparently no one had told her how seldom the elevators worked. She hadn't yet applied makeup, and her dark hair was still tousled and asymmetrical from sleep. She wore rubber thongs and a terry cloth beach coat loosely belted at the waist. Through her gaping lapels, I caught sight of a dark blue bathing suit. If the two were scheduled to depart that day, I didn't think she'd be dressed for the pool. She glanced at my camera, but avoided my eyes. I took my place beside her, looking up with blank attention as the indicator light moved haltingly from the third floor to the lobby. The elevator doors opened and two people emerged. I hung back discreetly, allowing her to get on the elevator first. The woman pressed 3 and then flashed an inquiring look at me. "That's fine," I murmured. She smiled at me vaguely, with no real intention of being friendly. Her narrow face looked pinched, and dark shadows under her eyes suggested she hadn't slept well. The musky scent of her perfume filled the air between us. We rode up in silence, and when the door slid open, I gestured politely, allowing her to get off first. She turned to the right and headed for a room at the far end of the corridor, her flip-flops slapping against the tiles as she walked away. I paused, pretending to search my pockets for my key. My room was one floor down, but she didn't have to know that. I needn't have bothered with my wee attempt at deception. She unlocked the door to room 312 and went in without a backward glance. It was then almost 10, and the maid's cart was parked 2 doors away from the room the woman had entered. The door to room 316 was standing open, the room empty, stripped of occupants. I headed back to the elevator and went straight to the front desk, where I asked to have my room changed. The clerk was most accommodating, possibly because the hotel was nearly vacant. The room wouldn't be ready for an hour, he said, but I was gracious about the wait. I crossed the lobby to the gift shop and bought myself a copy of the San Diego paper, which I tucked under my arm. I went up to my room and packed my clothes and my camera in the duffel bag, gathering up toilet articles, shoes, and dirty underwear. I took the duffel with me to the lobby while I waited for the room change, unwilling to give Wendell the opportunity to skip. By the time I went up to claim 316, it was almost 11. Outside 312, someone had set a room service tray stacked with dirty breakfast dishes. I scanned the toast crusts and coffee cups. These people needed to include a fruit exchange in their overall meal plan. I left my door ajar while I unpacked. I had now placed myself between Wendell Jaffe and the exits, as both the stairs and the elevators were several doors to my right. I didn't think he could pass without my being aware of it. Sure enough, at 12:35, I caught a glimpse of him and his lady friend as they went downstairs, both now dressed for a swim. I moved to the balcony with my camera and watched them emerge on the walkway 3 floors down. I lifted my camera, following their progress in the viewfinder, hoping they'd alight within zoom range of me. They passed behind a splashy screen of yellow hibiscus. I caught a glimpse of them arranging their belongings on a nearby table, seating themselves with some attention to comfort. By the time they got settled, stretching out on their chaises in preparation for sunning, the flowering shrubs obscured all but Wendell's feet. After a decent interval, I followed and spent the bulk of the day within a few yards of them. Various pale new arrivals were establishing their mini-kingdoms, staking out their turf between the bar and the pool. I've noticed that resort guests tend to be territorial, returning to the same recliners day after day, reclaiming bar stools and restaurant tables in hastily improvised routines that would rival all their old boring habits at home. After one day's observation, I could probably predict how most of them would structure their entire vacations. My guess was they went home feeling ever so faintly puzzled that the trip hadn't generated the kind of rest they were looking forward to. Wendell and the woman had parked themselves two loungers down from the spot they'd occupied the day before. The presence of another couple suggested they hadn't been quick enough for the location they really wanted. Again, Wendell occupied himself with two issues of the news, one in English from San Diego and one in Spanish. My proximity attracted little notice, and I made a point of making no eye contact with Wendell or the woman. Casually, I took pictures, feigning interest in architectural details, arty angles, ocean views. If I focused on anything in range of them, they seemed to sense it, retreating like exotic forms of sea life recoiling in self-protection. They ordered lunch by the pool. I munched on some wholesome chips and salsa at the bar, nose buried in a magazine, but keeping them in view. I sunbathed and read. Occasionally, I went over to the shallow end of the pool and got my feet wet. Even with the oppressive July temperatures, the water seemed nippy, and if I lowered myself into the depths by as much as 6 inches, I suffered shortness of breath and a nearly overwhelming desire to shriek. I didn't really relax my vigilance until I heard Wendell make arrangements to go deep-sea fishing the following afternoon. Had I been truly paranoid, I might have pictured the outing as a cover for his next big getaway. But at that point, what did he have to get away from? He didn't know me from Adam, and I hadn't given him any reason to suspect that I knew him. To pass the time, I wrote a postcard to Henry Pitts, my Santa Teresa landlord. Henry's 84 years old and adorable. Tall and lean, with a great set of legs. He's smart and good-natured, sharper than a lot of guys I know who are half his age. Lately, he'd been on a tear because his older brother William, who was now 86, was having a geriatric fling with Rosie, the Hungarian woman who owned the tavern down the street from us. William had come out from Michigan early the previous December, fighting off a bout of depression that descended on him in the wake of a heart attack. William was a trial under the best of circumstances, but his brush with death, as he referred to it, had exacerbated all his worst qualities. I gathered that Henry's other siblings, Lewis, who was 87, Charlie, age 91, and Nell, who turned 94 in December, had taken a completely democratic family vote, and in Henry's absence had awarded him custody. William's original 2-week visit had now expanded to 7 months, and the personal proximity was taking its toll. William, a self-absorbed hypochondriac, prissy, temperamental, and pious, had fallen in love with my friend Rosie, who was herself bossy, neurotic, flirtatious, opinionated, penny-pinching, and outspoken. It was a match made in heaven. Love had turned them both rather kittenish, and it was nearly more than Henry could bear. I thought it was cute, but what did I know? I finished the card to Henry and wrote one to Vera, employing a few carefully chosen Spanish phrases. The day seemed interminable, all heat and bugs, kids shrieking in the pool with ear-splitting regularity. Wendell and the woman seemed perfectly content to lie in the sunshine and brown themselves. Hadn't anyone ever warned them about wrinkles, skin cancer, and sun poisoning? I retreated into the shade at intervals, too restless to concentrate on the book I was reading. He certainly didn't behave like a man on the run. He acted like a man with all the time in the world. Maybe after 5 years he no longer thought of himself as a fugitive. Little did he know that officially he was dead. Around 5, the viento negro began to blow. On a nearby side table, Wendell's newspapers gave a rattle, pages riffled into snapping attention like a set of canvas sails. I saw the woman snatch at them with annoyance, gathering them together with her towel and her beach hat. She slid her feet into her flip-flops and waited impatiently for Wendell to collect himself. He took a final plunge in the pool, apparently washing off the sunscreen before he joined her. I collected my belongings and left in advance,
conscious that the two of them were not far behind. As anxious as I was to maintain a connection, I thought it unwise to be any more direct than I'd been. I might have introduced myself, striking up a conversation in which I might gradually bring the subject around to their current circumstances. I'd noticed, however, their scrupulous avoidance of any show of friendliness, and I had to guess they'd have shunned any overtures. Better to feign a similar disinterest than excite their suspicion. I went up to my room and shut the door behind me, watching through the fisheye until I saw them pass. I had to assume they'd hole up the way the rest of us did until the winds had died. I took a shower and changed into a pair of dark cotton slacks and the dark cotton blouse that I'd worn on the plane. I stretched out on the bed and pretended to read, dozing intermittently until the corridors were quiet and no noises at all filtered up from the pool. I could still hear blowing sand slant against my sliding glass door in gusts. The hotel's air conditioning, which was fitful at best, seemed to drone off and on in a fruitless attempt to cut into the heat. Sometimes the room would be refrigerator chilly. The rest of the time, the air was merely tepid and stale. This was the kind of hotel that generates worries about exotic new strains of Legionnaire's disease. When I woke, it was dark. I was disoriented at first, unsure where I was. I reached out and turned the light on, checking my watch. 7:12. Oh, yeah. I remembered Wendell and the fact that I was dogging his trail. Had the pair left the premises? I got up from the bed and padded to the door in my bare feet, peering out. The hall was brightly illuminated, empty in both directions. I slipped my key in my pocket and left the room. I moved down the hall, passing 312, hoping a crack of light beneath the door might indicate that the room was occupied. I couldn't tell one way or the other, and I didn't dare risk plastering my ear to the door. I went back to my room and slipped my shoes on. Then I went into the bathroom, where I brushed my teeth and ran a comb through my hair. I snagged a shabby hotel towel and took it out on the balcony, placing it on the railing near the right-hand side. I left my room lights on, locked the door behind me, and went downstairs with my binoculars in hand. I checked the coffee shop, the newsstand at the lobby, and the bar downstairs. There was no sign of Wendell or the woman who accompanied him. Once outside on the walkway, I turned and lifted my binoculars, skimming my sights across the hotel's facade. On the top floor, I spotted the towel on my balcony, magnified now to the size of a blanket. I counted two balconies to the left. There was no sign of activity, but Wendell's room lights were dimly visible and the sliding glass door seemed to be halfway open. Were they gone or asleep? I found the house phone in the lobby and dialed 312. No one answered my ring. I returned to my room, tucked my room key, pen, paper, and my soft-sided flashlight in my pants pocket. I doused the lights. I went out onto my balcony and leaned my elbows on the railing, staring out at the night. I kept my expression contemplative, as though I were communing with nature, when I was really trying to figure out how to break into the room two doors over. Not that anyone was watching. Across the face of the hotel, less than half the rooms were lighted, bougainvillea trailing like dark Spanish moss. I could see an occasional guest sitting out on the balcony, sometimes a cigarette ember glowing in the shadows. By now it was fully dark, and the grounds were plunged in gloom. The exterior walkways were lined with little low-voltage lamps. The swimming pool glowed like a semi-precious stone, though the filtering system was probably still laboring to remove all the soot. On the far side of the pool, some sort of social event was just getting underway. Music, the buzz of conversation, the smoky scent of grilled meat. I didn't think anyone would notice if, chimp-like, I swung from one balcony to the next. I leaned forward as far as I could and peered right. The adjacent patio was dark. The sliding glass door was closed and the drapes were drawn. I had no way of knowing if the room was occupied, but it didn't seem to be. I was going to have to risk it in any event. I swung my left leg over the railing and tucked my foot between the pails, adjusting my position before I swung my right leg into place. The distance to the next balcony was a bit of a stretch. I grabbed the railing and gave it a preliminary yank, testing it against my weight. I was aware of the yawning three-story drop, and I could feel my basic dislike of heights kick in. If I slipped, the bushes wouldn't do much to cushion my fall. I pictured myself impaled on an ornamental shrub. Not a pretty sight, that one.
A hard-assed private eye punctured by a sticker bush. I wiped my palm on my pants and reached across again. I extended my left foot and inserted it between the pails on the next balcony. It's never smart to give a lot of thought to these things. I made my mind a blank and hauled myself clumsily from my balcony to the next. In silence, I crossed my neighbor's patio and went through an identical procedure on the other side. Only this time I paused long enough to peer around the corner and satisfy myself that Wendell's room was empty. The drapes were pulled back, and though the room itself was dark, I could see a rectangle of light slanting out of the bathroom. I reached across to his railing, again railing, testing my weight before I ventured the distance. Once on Wendell's balcony, I took a little time to catch my breath. A breeze touched my face, the chill making me aware that I was sweating from tension. I stood near the sliding glass door and peered in. The bed was a king size, the cotton spread pulled down. The sheets were a tangle, showing the tousled imprint of a little pre-dinner sex. I could smell the lingering musk of the woman's perfume, the damp smell of soap where they'd washed up afterward. I used my little pocket flash to amplify the light seeping in from outside. I crossed to the door and secured the chain, peering through the fisheye at the empty corridor beyond. I checked the time. It was 7:45. With luck, they'd taxied into town for dinner as I had the night before. I flipped on the overhead light, trusting Providence. I did a visual survey of the bathroom first, since it was closest to the door. She had covered the counter on either side of the sink with a profusion of toiletries. Shampoo, conditioner, deodorant, cologne, cold cream, moisturizer, skin toner, foundation, blusher, loose powder, eyeshadow, eyeliner, mascara, hair dryer, hairspray, mouthwash, toothbrush, toothpaste, floss, hairbrush, eyelash curler. How did the woman ever manage to leave the room? After doing her toilette every morning, it'd be time for bed again. She had washed out two pairs of nylon underpants, which she'd hung over the shower rod. I had pictured her in black lacy bikini briefs, but these were that serviceable, high-waisted style favored by lingerie conservatives. She probably wore bras that looked like corrective appliances after back surgery. Wendell had been accorded the lid to the toilet tank, where his DOP kit sat, black leather with a monogram in gold that read DDH. That was interesting. All he carried with him was a toothbrush, toothpaste, shaving gear, and contact lens case. He probably borrowed her shampoo and deodorant. I checked my watch again. The time was 7:52. I peered through the fisheye with caution. So far the coast was clear. My tension had passed, and I suddenly realized I was enjoying myself. I suppressed a quick laugh, doing a little dance step in my tennis shoes. I love this stuff. I was born to snoop. Nothing's as exhilarating as a night of breaking and entering. I turned back to the task, fairly humming with happiness. If I didn't work in behalf of law enforcement, I'd be in jail, I'm sure. Chapter 4. The woman turned out to be the sort who unpacked all her suitcases, probably within minutes of checking into her room. She'd taken the right side of the double dresser, and she'd filled the space neatly. Jewelry and underwear in the top drawer, along with her passport. I scribbled down her name, which was Renata Huff. Passport number, birth date, place of birth, the passport agency that had issued the document, and the date of expiration. Without searching further among her personal effects, I checked the top drawer on Wendell's side of the dresser, hitting pay dirt again. His passport indicated that he was using the name Dean DeWitt Huff. I made a note of the data and checked the fisheye again. The corridor was empty. It was now 8:02, probably time to scram. With every additional minute, there was an accelerating risk, especially since I had no idea what time they'd left. Still, as long as I was there, I thought I'd see if anything else turned up. I went back and opened the remaining drawers systematically, sliding my hand under and between the neatly stacked articles of clothing. All of Wendell's clothes and his personal effects were still in his suitcase, which was propped open on a stand. I worked in haste, with as much care as I could muster, not wanting them to discern my presence after the fact. I lifted my head. Had I heard a noise or not? I checked the fisheye again. Wendell and the woman had just emerged from the elevator and were heading in my direction. She was visibly upset, voice shrill, her gestures theatrical. He was looking grim, his face stony and his mouth set, slapping a newspaper against his leg as he walked. One of the things I've learned about panic is that it inspires gross errors in judgment. Events take place in a blur in which the instinct for survival, winged flight in this case, overrules all else. Suddenly you find yourself on the far side of a crisis in worse shape than you were to start. The instant I spotted them, I tucked all my personal items in my pants pocket and slid the security chain off the slide track. I reached for the bathroom light and flipped it out, flipped out the overhead light in the bedroom, and then moved speedily to the sliding glass door to the balcony. Once outside, I glanced back to assure myself that I'd left the room just as I'd found it. Shit! They'd left the bathroom light on. I'd flipped it out. As though with X-ray vision, I could picture Wendell approaching on the far side of the door, room key at the ready. In my imagination, he was moving faster than I was. I calculated rapidly. It was too late to correct. Maybe they'd forget or imagine that the bulb had burned out. I crossed to the edge of the balcony, swung my right leg over, secured my foot between the pails, swung the other leg over. I reached for the railing on the next balcony, crossing the distance just as the light in Wendell's room came on. I was acutely aware of the adrenaline that had juiced my pulse rate up into training range, but at least I was safe on the adjacent balcony. Except for the guy standing out there smoking a cigarette. I don't know which of us was more surprised. He was, no doubt, because I knew what I was doing there, and he did not. I had an additional advantage in that fear had accelerated all my senses, giving me an exaggerated awareness of his persona. The truth about this man began to flash through the air at me like the subliminal messages suddenly made visible in a sports training film. The man was white. The man was in his 60s and balding. What hair he had was silver and combed straight back from his face. He wore glasses with the kind of dark frames that looked like they'd house hearing aids in the stems. The man smelled of